history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have some pretty incredible stories, if you're willing to take the time to listen. And each week, we listen to these stories from our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a whole lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and oftentimes inspired. And maybe we'll check all those boxes today with 89-year-old Donald Newsom, lives in the Dallas Retirement Village in Dallas, Oregon. Beautiful spot to hang out today. And you're an Oregon native. You grew up in Jervis. Where in the world is Jervis, Oregon?
You know where Woodburn is?
Well, tell us.
We'll establish a point, and then we'll talk from there. Jervis is about 3 miles south of Woodburn. Population around 1,500.
So a small town in Oregon is where you grew up, and we're going to hear the story of the most heavily damaged aircraft carrier to actually survive World War II, because Mr. Newsom was on the Big Ben, the USS Franklin. But long before you ever ended up on the Franklin, you're growing up in that small town of Jervis, Oregon. Do you remember some of the dreams you had or the ambitions you had as a young boy there?
One, I wanted to get involved in the war because that was a patriotic thing to do. And a little excitement, I guess.
And you're one of the young World War II veterans. You're not even 90 yet, just 89 years old. So you were pretty young when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember how you found out about that?
Heard it come over radio right there in Salem about the Japanese attack.
What did that mean to you? Because I'm sure you'd never heard anything like that on the radio before.
No, and we thought that, you know, the U.S. will end that war in a few months anyway, because we're the big nation, you know.
But they didn't end it in a few months, and a couple years later, it's still going on, and you're 17 years old, and what, you begged your parents to sign to let you go in?
Well, it's what everybody, all the boys was doing that was physically able to join the service. Didn't realize all that was going to happen. It was out there ahead of you.
So why the Navy? Why did you want to be a Navy man?
I didn't want Army, and Navy was accepting. So there was a place there in Salem on High Street. You go in there and sign up. They had to have my parents' consent, too, because I was only 17.
And how was it that you ended up on a ship that remains famous 70 years after World War II because of the incredible amount of firepower that it sustained and survived out there in the Pacific? How'd you end up on the Franklin, Big Ben?
We got on a troop transport out of San Francisco. When we got to Ulithi, Rannawito, which was just a forward base out there, I was transferred from this transport ship, had about 5,000 boys on it, and 24 of us was put on the Franklin, and we were received very well. They didn't want us or need us. It already had more, it was short of space, but that remained a joke for a while.
Well, I'm sure they gave you the lay of the land, or at least the lay of the ship, so to speak. What do those guys who were already on the ship tell you about what to expect?
It wasn't that much communication. It stayed basically with the 20-some guys that went on board with.
Was it a little bit amazing or awe-inspiring or mind-blowing to grasp the scope of this and the size of this ship? Because there's more people on this ship than in your hometown.
Yeah. The complement on that ship was 3,000, a little over 3,000. If the admiral and his group was aboard, why, he added another few hundred. Yeah, a fair-sized city.
Yeah, a floating city and a floating target for the Japanese. Tell us what your duties were on the Franklin. Where did they put you?
Well, I ended up in what they call number one inert gas pump room. Inert gas is a gas that they take the exhaust from a four-cycle engine and catch the fumes, they put it through different types of filters, put it in a big tank and store it. So when you gas the aircraft, when the instant you're done, you pull that gas back down and shoot this inert gas into the line. So if the ship was hit, why, it ain't going to catch the whole thing afire, because it only takes a pinpoint a hole the size, from shrapnel that big, and if there's gas shooting out there, why, it gets a fire.
So the whole point, if I understand it, the whole purpose of your job on that ship is to prevent damage, is to limit damage and not have it spread through the whole ship.
That's right.
Did you think that that was going to become an issue, that you would have to do that to save the ship or to prevent some damage?
That wouldn't, what was done didn't save that ship. It was too far gone before, the whole aft two-thirds was afire, and blew up. There's also ammunition and stuff that's under those decks, and when the ship was hit, it slowly got in there, not slowly, but before too long, the whole rear part of the ship was afire.
Yeah, and maybe you can tell us that story as you understand it, both from what you experienced firsthand and what you've learned over the years. I know you've been to a lot of ships reunions with your fellow sailors from the Franklin, but this is March of 1945. You're a couple weeks shy of your 19th birthday, so you're an 18-year-old kid on this big ship. What happened that day on March 19th of 45?
A Japanese aircraft came out from off of Kyushu. That was the southernmost island. That's the island that we were off of, about 40, 50 miles. This guy in this plane flies out there. They stay right down over the water so they can't be detected. Then just before they get to where, they know where you are. Why, they shoot up and then right back down and either blow something up or kamikaze or something. Well, he went up and dove in. He dropped two 500-pound bombs, as I recall, was the way the story went. They had armored and gassed aircraft that morning so that they acted as if, gee, there's no danger here, and relaxed what they should have been doing, and they caught fire and blew up. And 900 boys that morning lost their lives from that one plane that went up and then dropped his bombs. And when he dove, caught the corner of the ship after he dropped his bombs.
So you had the two bombs, the impact of the plane, plus the fuel that was there from American planes on the deck. So this is a massive explosion. And as you just told us, nearly 900 American sailors on your ship lost their lives in that incident. From where you were, I'm sure as big as this ship is, no matter where you were on that ship, you probably had to feel that explosion and that impact, right?
Feel a shudder, because the Quad 40s had their ammunition under the decks, under the flight deck, and the 20 millimeters too. And of course, those things, that stuff all caught fire pretty quick, and so it could blow itself up.
So from that point on, what did you experience, and what did you see?
I had just met with my buddy from California. We met in Idaho.
So you had trained together in Idaho, and he's still your buddy on the Franklin.
And we ate breakfast, and then he headed back to the apartment, and I went back to my station on this gas pump. This pump room was fourth deck forward under the forecastle of the ship. And then for a few hours, I could hear water running above. You don't know what's up there. I knew we were afloat, but listing pretty heavily. Because of just to walk across the deck down in there, so with this pump room, it's also the catapult pump room for the catapult the aircraft off the ship, down in there, all that hydraulic stuff. And
so you really don't know how extensive the damage is. You're getting no communication or anything. You're just stuck down there doing your job.
There was 16 of those walkie-talkie phones, that belonged to the gas division. And we were in contact all time, because when you get ready to bring the gas up, pump the gas back down, put in the inert gas, you would communicate with those guys at different parts of the ship. So you knew what was happening. You were also locked in there because they closed those hatches. Regardless of who or what, they shut you off in order to make the ship more stable.
Right, so damage is compartmentalized. So basically what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm reading between the lines. I think what I hear you saying is that if that ship had gone down, there was no way for you to escape. You would have been stuck in that room and gone down.
When I first started, we had contact, our pump room, with the rest of the ship. When I first started talking, there was these 16 guys, including myself. Well, after about an hour or so, pretty soon you only hear about eight of you to ask, because we knew the names of all these guys. They're in our division on the ship. Some of them got up out of there clearing the aft end. had a couple of buddies from California that made it up out of there.
They abandoned their post to try to survive?
Yeah, right. But, of course, the whole rear end, the whole aft end of that ship was afire.
Did you know that at the time or no?
Oh, I didn't know very much. Anybody I tried to talk to didn't want to talk. It was on that other end of that phone.
So what's going through your mind? I mean, I'm just imagining myself in your shoes as an 18-year-old kid. I think I would have been scared out of my mind. What was going through your head?
I wasn't scared out of my mind, but my boss was a second-class PO, and, of course, he was in charge of that pump room down there. There was only two of us that worked that pump room. Me and I was his flunky. His nickname was Puppy. Puppy, we got to get up out of here. He said, no, he says, we're okay here. We're at least alive. And another kid had come down from Chow Hall when the thing first got hit and come charging in there and went over and sat in the corner and didn't want to talk at all. There'd been some explosions up there where he was, and he knew where our inert the gas pump room was, so that's what he did. He headed for that. And, of course, he went down another deck.
Were you starting to wonder if you were going to survive this?
Not at that point yet. I told him, Puppy, I says, I'm getting up out of here. I don't care. I couldn't talk to two guys. They'd all abandoned their posts or something, and we're getting out of there.
So what did you do?
Well, we went up out of there, the three of us, Golosowski and Puppy and myself. And you just spin those hatch lids loose, you know, the one for the man. The man's only about this. The regular hatch is about 4 foot square for putting stuff in and out, up and down. When you spin that lid, unlock that lid, why, nothing coming through there but water. I don't know whether that's going to fill this compartment I'm in or what. When it gets full, where am I going? They go to the next one and spin it loose, because we're down four deck forward. But the three of us come up out of there, and I told Puppy, I says, I'm going to take a look around. He says, I'm staying right here. There was the whole forecastle was full of sailors. I went ahead and went on up, clear up on top. The aft two-thirds was afire, the one-third forward. Have you ever seen a picture of that Franklin alongside the Santa Fe?
Yeah, and I'll put that picture on our website at hometownheroesradio.com. I mean, you see that this ship is going up in smoke. What did you see when you got on top deck?
Huddles of men of 40, 50, maybe 100. The flight deck forward was never afire. Well, those people were on stretchers that was injured or hurt.
And you saw the fire still going on the other half of the ship?
Yes. And they asked for volunteers to go back there and relieve these guys on the hoses. And they were working with one-third or one-fourth the water that they normally pressure with, because that stuff was already some of it destroyed.
Most of us have never been in a situation like this, and it just sounds extremely chaotic. When you got up there and you saw what you saw, was it worse than what you expected to see?
Never even thought of that. I know it's bad enough. And they were asking for volunteers to go back and relieve the boys on the hoses, and the hoses they had wasn't squirting a garden stream, because that stuff was all burnt and destroyed, a lot of it.
So did you volunteer or no?
I started back there about 50 feet, and one of the ammo stations for the 20 millimeters on the blue, and I thought, well, this don't make sense, go walking through that stuff. And when those things did go off and blow, by parts of the aircraft, you'd look up and there would be a chunk of an engine and stuff flying through the air.
I'm not trying to be melodramatic here, but I think everybody listening probably wants to know, in that moment when your ship's on fire, things are exploding left and right, you're seeing pieces of airplanes flying through the sky, stretchers everywhere, guys that are killed and wounded, did you think you were going to make it to 19?
That never crossed my mind.
Well, I guess that's probably a good thing. It was time for action. And when we come back, we'll hear how Don sprang into action atop that burning carrier, the USS Franklin. This is one of those stories where pictures can make a big difference. And I encourage you to go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and even video from March of 1945. We'll pick up Mr. Newsom's story when we come back. And we'll also hear from one of his neighbors at the Dallas Retirement Village in Oregon. Hometown Heroes will be right back. back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, 2 for the price of 1 today. In a while, we're going to hear from a medic who was captured near the end of the war in Europe and put on a forced march with other prisoners, many of whom had been in captivity for quite some time. For now, we'll pick up where we left off with Donald Newsom, originally from the small town of Jervis, Oregon. He joined the Navy at age 17, and he was 2 weeks shy of his 19th birthday on March 19, 1945, a day that anybody who served on the Franklin will never forget. The carrier was within 50 miles of the Japanese mainland and had more than 30 airplanes fueled, armed, and warming up on the flight deck. They would turn into accelerant for a massive fire started by 2 500-pound bombs dropped from a Japanese plane. We heard Mr. Newsom explain how he felt that blast from below deck in the inert gas pump room where he was stationed. When we left off, he had just emerged topside on a once mighty ship that was now listing badly and burning almost everywhere.
Our air officer, Commander Taylor, came through there and he come up to me, he says, "You look like a strong, strapping young fellow." He says, "I got 6 patients up here with flash burn from the bomb, and just it burns their skin. Have you ever seen flash burn?" Mm-hmm. "Yeah." "Well, they were walking, but they were peeled their skin because they was back where some of those things had exploded. They could walk out of there. Santa Fe would come in alongside, and it'd get too hot for her back there on the half end. And because she was exposed to, well, all that fire, anything is a fire, 2/3 or 3/4 of it is a fire of the Franklin." When he came up to me, he said, "Cause I got 6 walking patients up here. Hope these guys get over on the Santa Fe." They were running lifeline, tie it to a rope. The Santa Fe set down 20, 30 feet lower than the flight deck of the Franklin.
So you had to load them onto that line and give them a little shove?
Well, yes. Yeah, so you walk up there and get down in that catwalk. But the Santa Fe's in so close that she would hit some of those catwalks, you know, and just upend them right up on, because she's staying in there close to take off casualties.
Have you ever considered how much worse the damage would have been, or the casualties would have been, if the Santa Fe weren't there?
Oh, yeah. She was wonderful help. I know that. And when in later years with the reunions, when we'd have them wherever they were, there'd be usually some Santa Fe boys there. And just like a brother.
Well, speaking of, you mentioned your friend from California who you had known from training in Farragut, Idaho. Do you remember his name?
Yeah, Herbert Melville Owen.
And you mentioned that you had just said goodbye to him. What happened to him?
He went in the water. He was blown off. Then they picked him up with a destroyer, and then he got transferred to a troop transport, which had gathered a bunch of those boys. And I didn't know for a week whether he was alive or not, you know. But we had just had chow together, breakfast down in the cafeteria, and then walked out of there, and I feel this rumble from starting to, she was already been hit and starting to blow apart.
How long was it from the time your ship was hit until you finally felt like things were safe again?
The ship was hit at around 8 o'clock, 4 or 5 hours later. It was about 5 hours, I think.
Longest 5 hours of your life?
I never put any of that stuff into perspective at all.
Well, speaking of perspective, you've got 70 years worth of perspective on it now. When you look at one of those pictures of all the smoke coming from Big Ben, does it amaze you that that ship survived?
Yeah.
What's the most amazing part of that whole story to you when you think back and you think about what you experienced personally and the rest of what you know now?
The question goes into my mind, why? Why did it spare me? And these other 900 guys are at the bottom of the sea or, you know, gone. So that's what I think about. Try not to think about it. There's some other stories, too, with that. The forward elevator to run an aircraft up and down from the hangar deck to the flight deck, just in front of that is the forecastle where the officers' quarters are. Went walking around up there. That was the only part that wasn't a fire. I don't know how many people was up there, but there was a bunch of them, the boys, you know, those that got out of from somewhere. My buddy that I went to Farragut with, he jumped out from our compartment. Our compartment was one that had a few man portholes big enough to get a crawl a man through, and he got out that way. He didn't have to go and hit the water. The destroyers was in picking boys up here and there. That some of them got trapped back at the aft end, couldn't get forward. And then the planes that was on the flight deck were running, operates. They had the engines running and the strike to launch, 30 aircraft ready to go. You come out of there and there's all this mayhem. You can walk right into a prop that's running. Because there's boys, the plane captains, he's back there with his pilot. And then you have the air officer up there that's sending those planes off. He spaces them out. Well, he only got one plane off out of that group.
And that happened to some people where they walked into the props?
Yeah.
Yeah, a catastrophic day, catastrophic scene. And when you talk about nearly 900 who died, I'm sure if you didn't know some of them well, you certainly knew some of those guys, right?
Yeah, you know of them. Even those in my division that was clear to the aft end, there was a pump room like where I was forward, and there was one aft, the same thing. But I didn't see those guys that much.
You mentioned that question, why me? Why did I survive? 70 years, have you ever come up with an answer?
No.
Some of the guys I've talked to who've lived through experiences like that speak of survivor's guilt, or feeling sometimes not guilt but obligation to make their life count because they know they could have been one of those who died. Have you ever experienced emotions or feelings like that?
Yeah, but not that graphic. I wouldn't be one to compose something like that.
You know, today, 70 years after World War II, we can talk about a number, 406,000 Americans who died in the war, and we can look at a wall of gold stars, the National World War II Memorial. But a good chunk of that came that day on your ship. How do you think those men should be remembered?
The respectful things that they do on holidays and the like of this, they're given notoriety. Same thing with the other wars. As somebody once said, war is hell, and that's no lie.
Well, I'm sure you've been asked a lot about the events of March 19th, but the war was far from over. Anything from that point till the Japanese surrender that stands out for you, or you think we ought to know?
No, we had them. By that point, they were pretty well squelched down. They were overwhelmed, and we were part of the overwhelming.
Was that a memorable day when you found out that Japan had surrendered?
Yeah, we got moved back to Pearl. From the time the ship was hit, it took us 2 weeks to get from out there and back in Pearl. Well, the ship didn't move. Well, they towed it for a day or two.
And you were still on it while they towed it?
No.
They had gotten you off. Did you go on the Santa Fe too, or what?
I went down the lifeline, you know, line about this big around, squeezed that line till I thought I was going to squeeze it all.
Well, why don't you tell everybody why? What happens if you don't squeeze?
Fall in between where the Santa Fe was in line alongside the Franklin, and the rough sea out there, that not rough, but rough. Why, when the Santa Fe, and then it gets so hot, there's a fire, and they'd have to pull away a little bit every once in a while. But then they bring that thing back in and bang right into the side of the Franklin in order to get up there. Some guys would walk to the edge there and then jump off and get, you know, anything to get out of there.
Well, and that's what strikes me, because, you know, these days people will pay big money to go hold on to a zip line and go for a little ride. But this was no joyride for you. You've got a burning ship that you think is going down, and that's why you're squeezing so tight, because your life's at stake, right?
That answers it.
Have you ever done anything like that since?
No. No. No.
When you went down that that lifeline, you had gloves on?
Yeah, flashproof glove in case it would be a hit, another explosion or something.
So that would protect your hands if there were an explosion, but they weren't made for holding on to a lifeline.
No, so I squoze for dear life, squeezed.
So those gloves were a problem when you're holding on to this line? They made you go too fast or what?
Well, they just, that would be the word, I guess, describe it, yeah.
Because you have a pretty vertical angle between where you're coming off the Franklin and where the Santa Fe was.
60, 70 degrees.
So if you come down that line too fast, you might get killed doing that.
Well, if you don't make it, you go down between the two ships, which were side by side. This was the problem.
You might get squeezed between the hulls of the two ships.
Well, some did.
That's one of those, the cure can be worse than the sickness situations, huh?
Yeah, some of them were most minor wounds, you know, that came over there and wanted to use those lines. But the boys on the Santa Fe would stand on top of that 6-inch gun turret. It's pretty flat, you know. And they had a landing there for about two or three different spots where these guys would slide down, save of quite a few.
How big of a relief was it for you when you were safely aboard the Santa Fe?
Oh, it took a while to get over that. Didn't even think about what it was. I just was thankful.
And when you got off that ship, did you think it was going to sink?
Yeah.
Well, as you said, a lot has been said, a lot has been written about your ship, the Franklin. But you were on it. You lived through all of this. You knew some of those guys that died. You had to evacuate yourself, holding on as tight as you could to get onto that Santa Fe. How do you think people should remember the Franklin? What's your ship's legacy?
I don't know. It just hope nobody, but you say hope that they don't have these situations anymore, but as long as this world is afloat, why, there's going to be problems.
Well, before I forget, I want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for giving us a look into that historic day on the Franklin. What would you say you're most thankful for?
Being here today. Yeah. Yeah. Why me? I ended up, I had about five buddies that was fairly close when we was on the ship. They were in different divisions and different things. And then we went through life and to these reunions and all. I'd see them every so often, you know. And that was always enjoyable. They're all gone. I'm the only one left of those five.
Well, speaking of those reunions, did you guys, you survivors, did you have something that you did to honor the guys who didn't make it through that day?
Well, we had several programs every time you met. They were respectful to them. You ever heard of Father O'Callaghan? He was a Catholic priest and was on the ship, and he was quite a doer. Fear nothing. He just out up there on that flight deck going through these boys and talking to them with their rights, you know. Pretty brave Catholic priest.
So he's one of the guys that you look at as heroic that day.
Yeah, if didn't pay any attention to where he walked or where he went, or where he went up and knelt down in a circle of about 50 guys that was on stretchers and stuff on the forward part of the flight deck, which is our only area we had. It wasn't a fire.
Yeah, and you weren't the only one who saw Father O'Callaghan as a hero. He was originally offered the Navy Cross, and he turned it down. I have a photo up at hometownheroesradio.com of Father Joseph T. O'Callaghan receiving the Medal of Honor from President Harry Truman, because after a public outcry, the president decided that brave priest deserved our highest military honor. Here's an excerpt from his Medal of Honor citation. A valiant and forceful leader, calmly braving the perilous barriers of flame and twisted metal to aid his men and his ship, Lieutenant Commander O'Callaghan groped his way through smoke-filled corridors to the open flight deck and into the midst of violently exploding bombs, shells, rockets, and other armament. with the ship rocked by incessant explosions, with debris and fragments raining down and fires raging in ever-increasing fury, he ministered to the wounded and dying, comforting and encouraging men of all faiths. He organized and led firefighting crews into the blazing inferno on the flight deck. He directed the jettisoning of live ammunition and the flooding of the magazine. He manned a hose to cool hot, armed bombs rolling dangerously on the listing deck, continuing his efforts despite searing, suffocating smoke, which forced men to fall back gasping and imperiled others who replaced them. Serving with courage, fortitude, and deep spiritual strength, Lieutenant Commander O'Callaghan inspired the gallant officers and men of the Franklin to fight heroically and with profound faith in the face of almost certain death, and to return their stricken ship to port. The Franklin would return home, and so did Donald Newsom. His three kids, his grandkids, and great-grandkids, they're all thankful for that. And one more note on the USS Franklin. We talk so often to the veterans on this program about what could have been, how one moment, one twist of fate, or in the eyes of so many, an act of divine intervention could change everything. In that light, I think you'll appreciate this story, bearing in mind that the only ship to lose more sailors in World War II than the Franklin did was the USS Arizona at Pearl Harbor. There was a 34-year-old lieutenant who had been assigned to the Franklin. He'd been a high school basketball coach in the Midwest before the war. On the day he was supposed to ship out, his appendix ruptured, and he was forced to stay behind as his fellow sailors headed out. The man who took his place on the Franklin's crew was a good friend and fraternity brother of his named Freddie Stallcup. He had played quarterback in college at Purdue. Freddie was killed in that Japanese attack on March 19, 1945. He died in the place of his good friend, a man we know as the greatest college basketball coach of all time. Yes, John Wooden's appendicitis saved his life. Wooden never would have coached a single game for UCLA, let alone win 10 national championships. I'll let you soak that one in as we prepare for our final break. When we come back, we'll go from Navy to Army and hear from one of Donald Newsom's neighbors in Oregon, a medic from Kansas with a pretty compelling story of his own. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV. It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV Country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and conversations with a couple veterans I met at the Dallas Retirement Village in Dallas, Oregon, just outside of Salem, where you can hear Hometown Heroes every Saturday morning and every Sunday evening on affiliate KYKN, 1430 on the AM dial in Oregon's capital city. We heard from Donald Newsom, survivor of the USS Franklin. Now we're going to hear from Earl Proctor, who grew up in Galena, Kansas, the son of a World War I veteran. And you talk about a family of service. Earl is one of five brothers. One younger brother served in the Korean War, another in Vietnam, and the other two, like Earl, were in World War II, one in the China-Burma-India Theater, the other in the Marine Corps, wounded on Okinawa. Earl's job in Europe was to treat the wounded as he advanced with the 253rd Infantry Regiment, the outfit that saw the most intense action as the 63rd Infantry Division blazed a path of blood and fire through Germany in the spring of 1945.
We stationed there at Sargemine, and Sargemine was just across the river, and we were supposed to hold the lines because that was right after the Belgian Bulge, and we were supposed to hold the line there until we got ready to final jump off into Germany. And while we was there, well, we was making raids into across the river and up in the area. Our medical team, the four of us, was told to go and pick up a fella that was over the hill 4 miles out of the town. We went up this hill, and we was falling in kind of a little dead fur. I could see tracers going between me and the squad leader. And I said, let's hit the ground. We hit the ground. We laid there and listened to the bullets going right over our back for quite a while. Then we went over the top of the hill and down to, we could see the guy down there laying in the middle of the field, and he raised his arm up. And the medic that had been with the outfit had bandaged him all up and left him there. So we went down, put him on a stretcher, grabbed him up, and started running up the hill. We heard a shell coming, and looked back, and the shell went off right where we'd just been with him. And we picked him up again, run again. Another shell came off right just where we just was left there. We made it over the top of the hill and back. We carried him back into town. It's 4 miles back into town. So they gave us all the bronze medal for going out and hitting him and bringing him in. Anyway, when we jumped off for the final drive, we was going so fast that we went across the Rhine at Worms and then turned and went toward the south. And we was west, I think, of Nuremberg when we had B Company had went over one little knoll, and they was going up the second one. They got hit pretty heavy, and they called the aid station. We need medics, need them bad. And so the lieutenant looked around, and he got the first sergeant, the Jeep driver, and four of us medics that just came in. And the seven of us got on that Jeep and went around, and he said, well, this land hasn't been cleared as far as he knows, but he said, we'll try it. So we went around this whole knoll, and there's trees across the road. We just jump out and grab the Jeep, go out in the ditch, across the ditch, out in the field, and back on the road again. We went around the first hill, figured to get in between the two and go up and rescue those guys. Anyway, when we went around the hill, we drove into a farmyard. There was Germans everywhere, and they was all carrying burp guns, so Jeep driver stopped and started back up, and they just right underneath of us.
I think a lot of people who listen to this show have heard about a burp gun before, but you're talking about a very high-powered automatic weapon that can put out so many rounds that they basically just saw you in half, right?
And they didn't hit us because we all had medical armbands on, or everything on the Jeep was marked with Red Cross, but they captured us. And then they took us from there right back over behind that place into a little village, took us in, questions each one at a time. And they kept the lieutenant and one private, and we never did see them. Then they put us with an old Army veteran and with a rifle, and he started us walking. And we walked every day. And we was trying to join the big group of prisoners. They dumped out the Americans and the British out of the prison camps up north, and they was heading them toward Munich. We walked every day, and some days we'd spend the night in a barn. One night we spent a night in an old dungeon in a castle. Almost froze to death that night. One time we stayed in an old camp that had been vacated. All that was in there was just Russians. The Americans and the British had all been evacuated and headed south. So we finally joined that 2,000 group, and just a couple of days after that the war was over. So they said that 63rd was planned on going to the South Pacific. to finish the war over there. So they gave me my choice of going back to the outfit or going with the prisoner of war. So I chose the prisoner of war, and they took us up, all of us. And some of those guys had been in there a year and a half, 2 years, was just skin and bones. And we took them up there to northern Germany and went through processing. They fumigated them, gave them haircuts, and killed off some of the lice in the head, hair, head lice. Anyway, there we sent, they sent us on up to Le Havre. We was up there, and they fed those guys up, to feeding them eggnog and everything, trying to get them physically fit to ship home. And I worked on the ship coming home. I worked as a medic, and we had a crew working round the clock with rotating, taking care of those guys. And when we got into close to New York, everybody was up on deck to see the Statue of Liberty that was physically able. I don't think there's a dry eye on that deck. Anyway, we came back, and then I didn't have that much time over there, so they gave us a furlough, and then they sent us down to Hot Springs, Arkansas for R&R, and then from there, they sent me on to Seattle, and I was up there working in the medics, running the dispensaries, and we was processing the troops going to the South Pacific and the ones coming home from the South Pacific.
You shared a lot of information there, and I know we're short on time, but I want to flesh some more of that out. When you're a medic in that situation, and you described it for us, I want people to understand. I mean, there are some people in the medical corps that are at an aid station that might get shelled or something, but they're not out there in combat with the infantry, and you were, right? You're following the squad leader.
Yeah, I was. Sometimes when we went out with sent out company out, well, we would tag along behind as a medic for him, take care of the wounded. That's what happened to the one we picked up. The medic had doctored him up. He had 14 shrapnel wounds. They bandaged him up and left him there because they couldn't carry him. And so it was our job to pick him up, get him back. And we kept track of him, and he pulled through all right. So.
And you got a Bronze Star for rescuing him. What do you think would have happened to him if you guys weren't there?
I don't know how long he'd have to sit there, but I know that friends of ours in the Belgian Bulge, when they got overrun, that one of them that I knew from Seattle that I got acquainted with down in Yuma, and he'd been injured, and he played dead, and they went right by him and went on by. But he said they had a radio that could call out, but there was no way in the world any troops could get to him because so many Germans had already went by him. So he was down there for 24 hours, and his feet froze. Now he's got had special shoes.
Well, and that happened to a lot of guys in and around the Bulge. You mentioned also bringing that Jeep around and running right smack dab in all these Germans and getting captured. But you were telling the story so fast, it sounded like it wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, this is a big deal. This is your life. This is your freedom. What went through your mind when you saw how badly you were outnumbered and realized you're going to become a prisoner?
We really didn't know what to expect, and it was pretty scary because we didn't know what was going to happen. We still, after we went up there and got questioned, we still didn't know what he's going to do with us. So, but the five of us, they took out and separated us. When they took us in there and questioned us, all they asked us all these questions, what our artillery outfit was with us. And I'd say, I can't answer that. And they said, well, what anti-tank outfit was with you? And I said, I can't answer that. And he said, you can or you won't. And I said, I can't answer that. And he said, oh, here, take your stuff and get out of here. And those guys spoke good English. And I gathered up all my stuff there and put it back in my aid pack and walked out.
I've had several guys on this program who were part of the march that you're talking about, who were prisoners in those camps and were marched across Europe. So you're saying you guys had your own mini march and then joined that longer march with thousands of POWs. But those guys, the conditions they've described were pretty brutal. I mean, they had been starved for a long time. Maybe you'd been better fed recently, but still. No, you weren't. Okay, tell me the story.
Well, we ate onion stew pretty regular. Their food supply was limited. So what we got was very skimpy. If we got a small loaf of bread and a can of beef for the group, that was a good meal for us. That would hold us.
And you guys would march all day, right?
Yeah, we walked every day.
Where would you sleep?
We slept in different places. Like I said, one night was the dungeon, one night was in barns, one night was in an old camp that had been vacated of all the Americans. They kept a guard on us all the time. So
did you see people who couldn't keep marching, who had to fall out?
Yes, and in that 3,000 group, there was a lot of those guys fell out, and they had a wagon going along that would pick up the ones that couldn't walk anymore. Most of the fellows managed to walk. So many of them had diarrhea and stuff, so and they had their pants right lapped clear over in front of them and stuff with belts clear around the back. Some of them that weighed probably 200 and some pounds, probably down 100 and something. So,
how hard was that to witness?
It was tough. It was tough to see it. But then we took them up there to Camp Lucky Strike where I was at with the group, and they had three camps up there of all the VWs. They had eggnog in those 30-gallon drum garbage cans. Those guys go through and get a big canteen cup full of eggnog. They was feeling the eggnog and all that stuff, trying to get them physically fit to bring home. I kind of wonder sometimes how many of those guys lasted very long with the health that broke like it was.
Well, I've met a few of them, and they were pretty resilient, the ones that I had a chance to meet that survived this long. For you, though, were you, I imagine it gives you some hope if you come across a POW camp where the Americans and British are gone because they wanted to get away from the Russians. Does that tell you that you're not going to end up a prisoner forever, that there is light at the end of the tunnel?
We kept walking, thinking maybe we thought our outfit would finally liberate us. And we could hear them in the distance every night. But the next day we'd walk, get out of the range of the artillery. But then usually by the next night we'd hear artillery fire off in the distance. But they finally caught up with us. They pulled into the camp there where we sat with our own outfit. So they gave me a choice to come back to the outfit or go with them. So.
And that's pretty unique. Of all the prisoners of war that I've talked to, I don't know if I've ever met a guy who was liberated by his own division. So it was the 63rd that liberated you. And where was that?
They said we was 50 miles north of Munich. That's where they're supposed to be heading.
How did it come about? How did you realize that you're a free man again?
We didn't know it until one of the fellows got up that morning to go out to the latrine, and he yelled back and he said, "There's no guard on the door here at the barn." We was in a great big barn. We all got up and realized then that the Germans took off already. And that's just shortly that morning, Jeep pulled in the yard there, and our captain from our outfit told us that they was retreating. The Germans had been retreating out of there, so it was just a matter of time until the war was over.
That had to be a pretty good feeling.
It was.
You mentioned sailing into New York and seeing that statue, and you said there wasn't a dry eye. I guess that includes your two eyes. What was going through your mind in that moment as you looked at that statue?
Well, I didn't think we'd ever make it. When I went over, I seen so many people that got killed that I didn't think that we'd ever live through it. But when you hit the ground, two of you, and the guy next to you, when you get up to go, and you reach over and say, "Let's go," and he's dead. He got hit with a piece of shrapnel. You got missed. You make you wonder. You know that somebody was praying for you. So I think that I was well blessed to go through it without getting injured. Because anytime you see tracers going between you and the squad leader and not get hit with one of them.
And how much space was between you and the squad leader?
Well, probably 20 feet.
Close enough, yeah.
We hit the ground. We just laid there and listened to the bullets going right across our backs. So, and that's when I realized that even the buttons on your shirt felt like they's too thick. You try to hug that ground as close as you can get because, you know, the bullets are pretty close.
Well, I'm sure we only scratched the surface of your story, but I want to say thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us that. Is there anything else you think is important for us to know now, 70 years later?
No, I just wonder, you hear so much pro and con on this, how much we should get involved with other countries. But, you know, we stayed out of that war for so long that Germany had a pretty good start before we got in it. I think personally, if we hadn't got in it when we did, it wouldn't have came out like it did. Germany had all that land taken already, and they were there, and they had those big guns there at Le Havre that was shooting those big shells across into to England. They were sending those buzz bombs over there into England and stuff. And when we landed there, we had troops land there in Normandy. We lost a lot of guys there on that battle. But I think if we hadn't got in it right then when we did, we wouldn't have had the effect that we had.
That's a very good point historically, and a word of caution as we look toward the future. I wish we had more time. Two remarkable men with pretty captivating stories we've had the privilege of meeting today. For photos of Earl and Don and other related information, visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you can join us again next time for a conversation with the candy bomber of the Berlin Airlift, and reminding you once more that freedom is not free.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.